And who indeed is Evans the Atom? Is he the physicist that could literally end the world when they turn on CERN this Wednesday? Let's chat with Richard C. Hoagland about this when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. The man behind the world's biggest scientific experiment, which some critics claim could cause the end of the world, is a Welsh miner's son who has admitted blowing things up as a child. That's great, huh? Dr. Lynn Evans, who's been dubbed Evans the Atom, will this week switch on a giant particle accelerator designed to unlock the secrets of the Big Bang. But the 63-year-old physicist has revealed that his passion for science was fueled by the relatively small bangs that he had created with his chemistry set at his house in Welsh a long time ago. A handful of scientists, however, believe that this experiment at CERN could create a shower of unstable black holes that could literally eat the planet from within, and they are launching last-ditch efforts to halt it in the courts. One of them is Professor Otto Rossler. He's a retired German chemist. He said he feared the experiment may create a devastating quasar, a mass of energy fueled by black holes inside the Earth. Nothing, he says, will happen for at least 4 years. Then someone will spot a light ray coming out of the Indian Ocean during the night, and no one will be able to explain it. A few weeks later, we will see a similar beam of particles coming out of the soil on the other side of the planet. Then we will know that there is a little quasar inside the planet. Richard C. Hoagland, sounds frightening. It sounds like something the science fiction writers would come up with.
I was just going to say, you want to do a script on this?
My God.
You know, I've been following this with some interest because, frankly, I'm more interested in the politics around it than I am concerned about the danger. And I have a very unique perspective on the danger.
All right. I'd love to hear it.
If you believe, as Joseph, I can't remember Joseph's last name. The Oxford physicist.
Joseph.
Yeah.
Well, I'll find it. I'll get it for you, but go ahead.
Yeah. Anyway, I hate it when my mind does that. See,
I woke you up, didn't I?
Joseph Farrell.
Joseph who was on the show with you.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So he and I and people like Bavall, missing Robert tonight, and Graham Hancock and a few others, have been working in the vineyards for many years looking at the idea that we are not the first. We have been preceded by a much more sophisticated epoch of high technology and civilization that somehow did themselves in. If we follow that model, which is buttressed in our case by the evidence of ruins on the moon, on Mars, on some of the satellites of Jupiter, Saturn, mm-hmm. and this very peculiar, I mean, George, you've got to see these pictures of the flyby. They're absolutely bizarre.
Okay.
They look like the thing is not an asteroid. And that's why the camera was cut off 9 minutes before the really good pictures would have been downlinked to Earth.
There is one question I've got to ask you about the blurry picture I saw, and
right.
I could not figure it out. But there looked like little crater tracks leading up the asteroid or whatever this is. But right at the top, there were two or three squares.
Yes.
Perfect squares.
Geometry.
Now, that wasn't part of the camera picture.
No. This is part of the
object. All right, so you saw the same thing I did.
Yeah.
Okay.
Of course. And when you see what we're going to post in the next few days, you know, what I'm waiting for is some other data to come in from some of the other experiments on board.
Perfect squares.
Yep.
Asteroid impacts or whatever hit this thing, don't do that.
Well, look, if we want to get into this, and I want to get back to your
CERN,
point about the
yeah.
problem with CERN, if we have been preceded by an amazing multi-planet solar system-wide civilization, when I last looked, except for the planet that blew up, they're all still here,
mm-hmm.
including the Earth and Mars. So if we've done this before, if we are repeating a vast historical cycle, I mean, on Earth, archaeologists and anthropologists have discovered that various civilizations kind of recapitulate cycles of civilizations that have gone before. Like, we're supposed to be the iteration of Greece and Rome, right?
Right.
So if you posit this, that was an idea, by the way, that Roddenberry developed in Star Trek in some very interesting programs in the 60s. If you posit that the previous guys that were here before us, as I keep saying over and over again, our great-great-great-great-grandmothers, if they did this stuff we're now doing, and they didn't wind up blowing up the Earth or destroying it or sucking it into an artificial black hole because of their CERNs tens and hundreds of thousands of years ago, then it's unlikely that the current tinkerers are going to have any better luck.
But maybe they knew something that we don't.
That's always one of the gray areas. I am frankly not as concerned by the technical problems as I am with the political and the legal.
Right, but I mean, why would, for example, some real scientists, we've had Walter Wagner on the program, he'll be on again tomorrow,
right,
some real scientists are concerned that there could be a devastating quasar that could create and fuel black holes within this planet. I mean, they're not making this up.
No.
They truly think this could happen.
These are all models. These are all calculations. And unlike what some people are led to believe in school, figures can lie. It's what we used to call back when computers were first invented, and we're almost that old, right? Aren't we, George?
Yes, we are.
GIGO.
I think you still use a Chinese abacus.
The old abacus, yes. Yeah. That was right next to my slide rule.
that you keep in your pocket.
Remember GIGO?
Yeah.
G-I-G-O? Garbage in, garbage out.
Yep.
Depending on your assumptions, and most of these calculations are so what we call model dependent, that they really are not, it's almost like some of the climate extrapolations. All it takes is the effect of a butterfly's wing on the other side of the world to change the equation so that it no longer means what the scientist who's done the calculation thinks it means. So it really is completely up in the air. You've got people who think it's a problem, and you have people who think it's not a problem.
Would you take that chance?
No. And the reason is because I would go back and apply the maxim that Sagan personally told us back during the whole NASA Apollo quarantine controversy. Remember how before we went to the moon, there were some scientists who were claiming that there were little beasties on the moon,
yes,
microbes.
Yes.
And the astronauts would bring them back, infect the Earth.
The Andromeda strain.
And basically it would be Andromeda strain cubed. By the way, Robin and I rented a movie last night called Invasion with Nicole Kidman.
Was it good?
Really good. Some nice twists, very interesting writing, and she, of course, is great to watch in a film. So, but in that film, it was an intelligent virus that was invading the Earth, humanity, from person to person to person. So the theory back in the 60s, before we went to the moon, was we would go to the moon. There might have been life developed on the moon. That's how little we knew back then. Didn't know about the presence of resources or water, et cetera. I mean, the moon was virgin, untouched territory. Who knew what was on the moon? That's why we were going. So Sagan one day was part of this meeting, and he told me about it, and he told a bunch of us about it. The NASA was wrestling with what does it do? And the obvious idea was, well, you quarantine the crew. You don't let them anywhere near the biosphere of Earth for however long the doctors say it might be safe, which was calculated to be something like 21 days, which is the normal gestation period for most diseases that we have run into on this planet. So Sagan was part of this group and this committee that was making this decision, and he was asked how much he would spend on such a quarantine. And what he said was so classic Carl and so apropos to the CERN problem, because he said basically on the one hand, you have the worth of the Earth, which is an extraordinarily big number. You don't even have to know what the number is. How valuable is everything we all hold near and dear?
Exactly.
Everyone who's ever lived, every grandmother, every child, every memory, every historical event, every artwork, everything we care about is here, and that has a value. You can put whatever number you want on it, but it's big. It's really, really, really big. And then he said, you take the probability that we're going to find some viable microorganism on the moon that will come back to Earth and destroy everything we hold dear, which he said is a very small number. And he said, you multiply those two numbers together, and that's how much you spend on the quarantine.
Well,
now, that's how I approach the CERN problem. The idea, if I was in charge, I would not do it until we got space, you know, accelerators that could do it safely on the moon or some other place.
I mean, they already had a problem with the magnets that broke off. And they,
yeah, well, that's just an engineering thing.
Well, yeah, but they said the mistake was caused by their own mathematics.
Yeah,
so,
well,
I mean, here's my problem.
That makes you wonder about the mathematics.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Well, there's two different sets. One is how to build something, and the other is what will happen when you smash these tiny microscopic things together. The reason that this is all so interesting is because this is the first time at these energies that they've been going to smack things into each other meeting head on. In other words, this is a colliding beam system where you fire particles going one way, and then you fire particles going another way, and you have them meet in the middle and go smash. And that's the most efficient high-energy way to do this, but it now brings us into the realm where we might, in fact, inadvertently create astrophysically interesting things, including a mini, 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 mini black hole.
And this Professor Otto Rössler, the retired German chemist, says that we could expect major catastrophes, earthquakes, tsunamis that would occur at the points that they've emerged from the planet. I mean,
well, if you wind up creating a mini black hole, it falls to the center of the Earth. By the way, there is one argument that someone on one of the shows you did with a physicist who's really the most upset about this.
Walter Wagner.
Yeah. Someone called in and said, but Dr. Wagner, there's no problem because, you know, objects, you know, microscopic atomic-sized particles have been zipping through the Earth from cosmic rays with much higher energies, and nothing like this has ever happened. And the difference, and this is an important thing for people to think about, the difference is that when you have a cosmic ray zipping through the Earth, it's moving in one direction, and the Earth is basically standing still compared to the speed of light these particles move at. Whereas with the CERN experiment, you basically are anti-colliding two beams directly into each other, like oncoming traffic. And what happens with the momentum then is it goes to zero, and the particles have no motion relative to the Earth, and they fall to the center of the Earth.
Let's go back a little bit when they were experimenting with the atomic bomb, and their calculations showed that there was a remote possibility.
Yes, and Beta and
blow up the atmosphere.
Oppenheimer were on opposite sides. They were actually taking bets if the nuclear weapon that they fired off here at Trinity in 45 in the summer on July 16th, a few miles south of me here, would actually ignite the nitrogen and the carbon in the atmosphere and cause a carbon-nitrogen
explosion,
which would have basically have incinerated the entire atmosphere of the Earth, and we would not be here talking about it if it had taken place.
Would you, if you were working on that project, would you have told them, folks, we can't do this. We're not going to test this.
See, this comes up against the hubris of scientists, which is second only to the hubris of doctors who consider themselves to be God.
Mm. Some. Not all.
We get to the point. Remember what Oppenheimer said when the weapon went off and did not destroy the Earth. You know, I have become death, destroyer of worlds, quoting from the ancient Vedas.
Exactly.
And he, by the way, thought that the Vedas were an ancient piece of prehistorical history, recording what the previous cycle of us nincompoops did in terms of developing these kinds of weapons of mass destruction, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So given that we've gone through this before, according to certain scholars and, you know, Joseph's work and my work and some others like Graham and Robert, is it not unexpected we'll do the same damn dumb things again, and there will be a clan of people with incredible hubris who think they know exactly how the universe is put together, and it's their arrogance of the infallibility of their calculations which is the scariest, because while in my gut level, I don't think anything's going to happen based on the reasoning that I've gone through in the last 20 minutes, I just have a feeling that it's wrong when a tiny, tiny, tiny group of people who are accountable to no one, abrogate to themselves the right to put all of humanity at risk.
And this was like a $6 billion project, something like that.
Well, it's not the only thing they're going to be doing. You know, it's only this one particular experiment that runs the risk of, you know, producing these kinds of particles. There's lots of other things they can do that are perfectly safe and expensive, but safe. It's this particular experiment which is causing the problem, because You're deliberately trying to create, at the highest energies attainable on Earth at the moment, these particles that are supposed to be fleeting representatives of things that happened at the beginning of the current cycle of the universe, the so-called Big Bang. And you're at the edge of the unknown.
When you're playing around with Mother Nature, Richard, something's bound to go wrong.
Well, on this scale, you know? I mean, we know that our super incredibly sophisticated intelligent ancestor did something really dumb, and they're no longer here. There's a whole bunch of ruins out there. There's nobody home, as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
That means that even very bright folks can do very dumb, stupid things.
Maybe the Mayans knew that by 2012, a black hole would have eaten the planet from within.
Well, see, now you get into an area that every time you mention this, I mean, at least you didn't mention asteroids tonight. Whatever the Mayans were talking to us about, and I think absolutely it was something really important, it has to be cyclical.
Yes.
It has to be something that happens again and again and again. And the reason the Mayans figured it out is because they didn't figure it out. They had a source. They had text. They had records. They had, you know, an archive. They had a fragment of an ancient library. They had something that came to them from the gods, so they believed it absolutely. And then they reiterated it in their own language, in their own time, as the timing. I mean, look at how fanatically devoted they were to time. If you knew the universe, everything you know is going to go through a wrenching, incredible, major catastrophe periodically, wouldn't you be kind of paying really close attention to the time?
Very close
attention. So it makes sense that the entire Mayan ethos, the whole raison d'etre for the culture, lived to forecast when this would happen again and make preparations in whatever, you know, personal philosophical perspective that they had for the afterlife.
If this thing ate the planet, would it continue eating things within the solar system, or would
it would become a black hole orbiting where the Earth is.
And what would happen to the moon? Get sucked in?
Depending upon if it ate the mass of the Earth, which is all it could eat, then the mass of the Earth would remain exactly the same as the moon, so the moon would be orbiting this apparently empty spot in space.
Amazing.
So you just have a moon going or a loop to loop to loop to loop around the sun with no primary, no Earth that it was orbiting.
And what about the satellites? Would they still stay in the geosynchronous orbit around nothing?
Probably not, because eating a planet is not a spherically symmetrical thing. You'd have all kinds of weird distortions of gravity.
Once it starts, would it happen quickly, or could this take hundreds of thousands of years?
Oh, no, it would happen very quickly because it's geometric. Remember the first Star Trek where Sulu talks about how the powers of this other guy, a member of the ship, who's been touched by this alien force, grows geometrically? It's like doubling your penny every day, 2 pennies, 4 pennies.
Yes.
You know, 8 pennies, 16, that kind of thing.
It's like the old rabbits.
Yeah, so it's a geometric progression. So it starts out slow and ends very fast, and the period of time to eat the Earth would be on the order of months.
What an incredible story. Stay with us. I think we'll open up the phone lines, and we'll chat with Richard C. Hoagland, take a question or two from you as well. Final half hour with Richard C. Hoagland, enterprisemission.com, darkmission.net, author of the book Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, we'll have Sound Off open lines for you. When we come back, we'll continue discussing things of all space things with Richard C. Hoagland, and also take your phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with Richard C. Hoagland, final half hour with Richard C. and you, your phone calls as well. Richard, anything new on Mars these days? Kind of quiet lately by the science boys.
Well, we talked a couple weeks ago about Dr. Chandra Wickramasinghe.
Yes.
Who is the astrobiologist at Cardiff University in England, who basically has come right out and said that NASA is lying to us about current life on Mars. And there are a lot of other things kind of moving in the dark that indicate that we may be on the threshold of some major announcement. And if that were to happen, George, if the White House were to officially announce that there is some even simple little microbes living in the soil on Mars, everything changes. your life suddenly gets a lot more complicated. And your sci-fi series goes into endless reruns. And they demand new shows. And a lot of people will probably talk to me in NASA who haven't talked to me in years, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So we could be on the threshold of something really interesting. Now, remember, I was the one at the Libertarian Conference.
Yes, you were.
In May, the night that Phoenix landed, that said that the White House probably was going to announce this before this election. Well, when you look at the mantle of change that John McCain has wrapped around himself now, it would be so fitting if the Bush White House, as their final positive thing they could do for an heir apparent, were to bequeath to John McCain the stunning news that there, in fact, is an inhabited solar system out there, and it's us and little tiny microbe-type guys on Mars.
Or more.
That would, well, what that would do, they would only have to announce that. What people would do in their own imaginations is take it to where it obviously goes.
Exactly.
Because if you have microbes, as Carl said, you know, it means that life has developed independently on two planets of the same solar system, ergo there's no limit to who or what could be living in the big galaxy, Mr. Scott, beyond, that could maybe find a way, given a more advanced technology, to come here. And then you have, of course, the body of evidence from the last 60 years, Roswell et al., that somebody has been coming here and looking us over really closely for a very long period of time. By the way, I want to clear up something as long as we're on the subject. Somebody got the idea that I came on here and said that I did not think that UFOs as representatives of ET technology were real.
No, you've never said that.
I've never said that. What I've said is that we ourselves, the human species, among certain elite groups, have sequestered the information for how to build those vehicles away from the general population. And that if somebody were to suddenly appear over major cities in a kind of a disclosure event, the odds are it would not be genuine ETs. It would be our guys running a scam, a so-called false flag invasion.
You know what? Friday night I had a quote. I had the audio clip of Carol Rosin talking about that. And what Von Braun had told her. And it seems like we're headed that way.
Well, based on the series that we put on the web, the Von Braun series, you know, what did Von Braun know and when did he know it? I can now demonstrate that Von Braun tripped over the idea that Newtonian gravity and Einsteinian relativity are not the last word in physics. And that he spent a lot of time quietly looking at frontier and cutting-edge physicists who basically were looking at alternative, radically different theories for how gravity works and how you might create anti-gravity than anyone would possibly imagine, given his background as a missile guy and launching satellites and building the Saturn V for the Apollo program. Based on that knowledge, George, I believe that when he told Carol what he told her, it was based on his personal knowledge that there, in fact, was some group developing this technology that politically, at the appropriate time, would basically jump in to the international scene and make some extraordinary claims and appearances for the purpose of misleading all of us into another direction of history. And that he was trying to warn her, based on his knowledge, that the physics that makes that possible is here on Earth right now.
Let's take some calls, and I definitely want to talk with you about your theory with Tom Van Flandern about Mars, because I need you to explain something about the water. But
okay.
Let's go to you, David, in Anchorage, Alaska, west of the Rockies. Hey, David, thanks for calling.
This is really an honor, Richard. I have been listening to you ever since White Springs days, if you
oh my God.
So, you know, I really, and you've got me interested in alternative energies, and I consider myself...
Well, it's the only thing that's going to save us, and hopefully we now have a window where people are mad as hell, and they're not going to be satisfied with concealment of really radical space-borne energy technologies that are, and this is the most important part, democratizable. What we want when we make this new transition to the next energy future of the planet, we don't want any more resources that a handful of tin-plated delusions of godhood, to quote, you know, Scotty on Star Trek, can get away with hijacking all the rest of us because they own it and we don't. We need democratizable so-called free energy, and the technology is out there. It's just
the technology is out there. It absolutely is out there, and that's what a lot of people don't know. The zero-point energy or the energy from the vacuum.
Whatever you want to call it, it's all the same stuff.
They call it many different things, but it's all basically the same thing. And this is what CERN, they're trying to find this by actually getting their hands on a Bose or a Higgs boson.
Mm-hmm.
And but you know as well as I do that we already have the technology. We don't need to risk the planet to try to find out something we already know.
Well, see, that gets into the political realm that George and I were discussing a little while ago. The thing that bothers me most is the political arrogance of these people, because it's like they're trying to reinvent the wheel. And frankly, I think they're really honest but dumb guys. And there's two sets of books. There's two sets of physics. There's the real physics.
There is.
That make possible the things that you and I were just discussing. And then there's
you know about super systems, and these guys basically are in denial of it on that end. On the
A lot of them are not so much in denial as they have been carefully been manipulated. Remember, the only way a physicist knows about reality, unless he's an experimental physicist, and there are very few of those, is by reading the papers of the guys that are actually doing the experiments. If those papers are cooked, if the results are manipulated, if the skies on Mars are blue and not red, everybody, then how is the average scientist going to know? The average scientist, particularly when he gets out of his specialty, is as ignorant as all the rest of us are about all the specialty stuff that we're told about constantly is going to kill us on this day and save us on the next day, and we have nowhere to turn. We don't know how to find out the truth for ourselves, because science has become a priesthood as opposed to the process of discovery that it used to be and has to become again.
You said it almost exactly the way Tom Bearden would have said it. you know my references here. Now, you know as well as I do, too, that there are levels of technology out there that even predate Tesla, which are technologies that would produce all the energy we could ever possibly use as consume as human beings. And they're free and readily available.
Well, that's what von Braun, if you read the series, tripped over, was basically free energy, which was a double whammy. Because, A, anti-gravity can't be allowed, because what does that do to the bottom line? And, B, free energy, oh, my God, if you give them free energy, we can't control them anymore. So the next energy transition, which is coming at Warp 9, cannot be drill, drill, drill. That is the stupidest thing, because what it does is put more money into the hands of the people who've been picking our pocket for the last 100 years in terms of oil. It's not the answer.
So true. Let's take some other calls. Say thanks for your call, by the way, David. Let's go to East of the Rockies, Bill in Chicago. Hey, Bill.
Yeah, scientists at Fermi Lab discovered a new subatomic particle, and the particle is called Omega-Sub-B, and it's in the Chicago Sun-Times Thursday edition. And this particle travels at 1/1,000,000th of 1 second, and it travels 1 millimeter and decays into lighter particles. So if you want to look up the article, just contact Sun-Times Thursday.
All right, great.
And one more thing.
Okay, sir.
When I worked for the Manhattan Project, there were two groups of scientists, and one wanted to build a super bomb, which was so powerful they had to explode in outer space. And another scientist, Dr. Oppenheimer, didn't want to explode it. So they took Oppenheimer's security away.
Huh. Did you know that, Richard?
That was the whole contretemps between him and Teller. And Teller eventually had his security clearance removed, which, by the way, President Kennedy restored before he was killed.
That's interesting. Eric, trucking around in California, you're on with us. Hi, Eric.
Hi, guys. I had a comment about the Hadron Collider. I can't believe all of these reports that say it's going to destroy the planet. I mean, every time we make a major scientific leap, they say it's going to kill us. You know, you guys were talking about the atom bomb blowing up the atmosphere. Well, if you go back farther than that, when the steam train first exceeded 40 miles an hour, there were very respected scientists that cited very real calculations that said that if you went faster than a horse could run, the flesh would melt off your bones. So I have trouble believing that these scientists actually know anything. It's like doctors. They call it practicing medicine for a reason.
Yeah, but the point is that George was arguing before, if you have a very tiny probability that something awful is going to happen, do you pull the trigger?
Exactly. You know, here's the other fascinating thing about CERN and what's going on. If they want to recreate the conditions that existed a fraction of a second after the Big Bang, what really caused the Big Bang? I mean, did we have some kind of particle accelerator going on then?
Well, that is the $64 trillion question, isn't it?
Water
I am not against basic science. I love basic science. But I also think that you need to do it smartly. We are a multi-trillion dollar a year global civilization. The other day I saw a calculation between the United States and Europe versus Russia in terms of who can swing their weight around.
Right.
Apparently the annual GNP of Russia is now about $2 trillion. Our annual GNP, U.S., is around $14 trillion. Europe is another 14 or 15, so it's around $30 trillion to $2 trillion in terms of monetary advantage we have over Russia. With that kind of money, given that all of NASA is only $16.7 billion a year, don't you think if somebody wanted to do some really dangerous high-energy experiments, they could go to the moon and build an accelerator on the moon and do it there? I mean, it's like we are now at the point where the really dangerous stuff should not be done in the living room, boys and girls. Do not try this at home. Take it out into outer space where it belongs.
Question about the water on Mars. Let's assume it had oceans, maybe even like Earth.
We don't have to assume.
Well, I mean,
we
really deep.
Ocean.
Okay, but where did the water go? I mean, some of it probably went down deep.
Well,
where'd the rest go?
Remember, in Tom's model, Tom Van Flanner in my model, Mars, which we have proven to our satisfaction and published, you know, on the web, the Water on Mars paper, which is available on Enterprise. We have proven now that Mars used to orbit another big planet in the solar system where the current asteroid belt exists, and that at some point, roughly 65 million years ago, for reasons that have not thoroughly been explained, in fact, almost not explained at all, that other big planet blew up, liberating Mars to wander in a much more elliptical orbit around the sun than it otherwise would have had. Now, blowing a planet up in your front yard, George, is not good for beagles or begonias.
No, not at all.
And it left it with incredible scars. It almost destroyed the planet, and it blew away the atmosphere and the oceans and the water.
Instantaneously?
Well, over a period of hours.
Okay. That's instantaneously, as far as
I'm
concerned.
Well, in terms of cosmic time, yeah. By the way, that was one of my big gripes with the first Star Wars movie, when George Lucas blew up, was it Alderaan?
Yes.
It happened much too fast. On a scale like that, a planet blowing up, it would have been majestic as opposed to an instantaneous thing. And that was the one thing they got wrong, was they didn't appreciate and put on the screen the true scale of planets blowing up as seen from a great distance away. It's like watching things in slow motion, like Edgerton's, you know, photography of bullets going through light bulbs and stuff like that.
Yeah, but the water, did it go off into space?
Yes, of course it went off into space.
And did some of it hit us?
Yes. And it formed things like comets. And there's these strange objects that are striking the atmosphere that were seen on certain ultraviolet satellites that he called mini comets. I think his name was Dr. Lewis Frank at the University of Iowa. And it became a very controversial scientific claim after a while because he claimed that we were being hit by thousands of these objects per day. And if they had the mass of ordinary comets, which is basically the mass of water, frozen water, ice, they would be the equivalent of detonating, you know, several kiloton nuclear weapons all over the Earth in the stratosphere every day. And of course, nothing like that is seen. Well, the reason is that the water is in the form of ice crystals of very low density, which makes these splotches on the photographs, but doesn't have any real mass. And the water, of course, is part of the oceans of the planet that blew up and Mars.
Let's go to Deborah in Wisconsin. You're on with Richard Hoagland. Deborah, hey.
Hi. Hi, Mr. Hoagland. I love your sense of humor.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I have two quick questions. They're unrelated, and I'll hang up, so if you could answer them, please. Could you tell me what you know about the 1,000-year-old astronomical observatory on the Yucatan Peninsula? It's referred to as a temple, C-A-R-A-C-O-L.
You mean the Caracol?
Yes, and that's my first question.
Okay.
I'll hang up. And my second question is, would you happen to recall there was a wind turbine that was proposed or was to be an ideal location for it off the East Coast near Senator Kennedy's home, and
That was shot down in Hyannisport.
Yeah, exactly. Strongly opposed it. It was shot down. If you could recall how much could have been produced out of that location, I'll hang up. Thank you, sir.
Okay, 1 minute, Richard.
Great. Thanks.
Good luck.
Okay, it's called the Caracol in Yucatan. It was built in the late Mayan period. It was not an observatory with a telescope like we have. It was a building that looked remarkably like an observatory, with slits in the walls, and they measured the alignments of celestial objects. And, of course, we now know why alignments, angular difference between two objects like Venus and the Moon, is important, because it modulates the background physics, and the Mayans knew about the physics. Even if they didn't know it was a physics, they knew that something having to do with time and astronomical observations was dependent on, basically determined the very lives they were leading as they were marking time to observe. On the Martha's Vineyard thing, I know there's been a controversy for years and years about putting a wind farm for generating a lot of megawatts of energy through wind turbines off Martha's Vineyard, and Senator Kennedy has been leading the fight against it because he doesn't want to mess up the environment of the ocean, and people have claimed he doesn't want to mess up his view. It's a little more complicated than that, but as far as I know, the environmental impact statements have gone forward, And the turbine farm is about to get its clearances.
Richard C., thanks for letting us wake you up tonight, huh?
Anytime, George.
All right, my friend. That's Richard C. Hoagland. I'll be back in a moment with Sound Off Open Lines on Coast to Coast AM.